I was barely in third grade when Morgan was involved in a plot to murder a man for money. I remember him and my mother talking about it, and I have a vague recollection of seeing courtroom sketches in the house. Morgan snitched, so he didn't get any time for accepting the payment. "Come on, it's only $5,000. No one will ever know," kept ringing in my ears. I sprang to my feet and began pacing the five or fewer steps between the little living room and the even smaller kitchen. Both seemed to shrink an inch with each passing second. "You don't have to do anything but give me the money," he said again. I was struggling to process what was actually happening here. I don't even think I'd received my first advance check, and already, my brother and mother were trying to get money out of me. And for what? To fuck up my mother's husband? What the fuck? Tragically, I wasn't surprised Morgan had begun to try and screw a siphon hose into me right away, but what got me to my feet and blew my mind was that my mother was going along with it. She remained savagely quiet the entire time Morgan spewed out conspiracy theories about blackmail, exposing and humiliating both her daughters, and her son arranging to fuck up her husband for money. Was she really willing to agree to place all of her children in such grave emotional, spiritual, and possibly legal peril? Or equally terrible, was she in on a plot with Morgan to extort money from me? Maybe she was just rendered powerless under his spell. I was not prepared for the implications all this was having on me and for my position in this family and in this world. Under no circumstances could I ever, ever entertain being involved in physically harming anybody, even a despicable dickhead like her husband. I categorically refused to even entertain their sick scam. Yet what was really beating me down was that I knew that if I gave Morgan this first $5,000, and if he did something violent or criminal, he would definitely blackmail me. This would be the first 5,000 drips in a faucet he would use to drain money from me forever. How delusional of me to even entertain the notion my mother and brother were going to toast me for making my only dream come true. Instead, they called me back to gut me. I was in a sad shock. I don't recall exactly what I said, but I remember walking in tight circles, that sick feeling now in my heart and pounding up to my eyes, and I was shaking my head, "No, no," and something unseen inside me snapped, and I broke away from that pack. I stumbled out of the shack, knowing without a doubt that I did not belong to any of them. My father was estranged, my sister burned and sold me out. And now there was no more brother and no more mother, standing alone. Still bruised, still walk on eggshells, same frightened child, hide to protect myself. Can't believe I still need to protect myself from you. But you can't manipulate me like before. Examine 1 John chapter 4, verse 4. And I wish you well. I wish you well. So, by normal standards, a record label reaching out to family for help in communicating with an artist was not a risky move, but they did not know the bad, bad moves my family could make. You, dear children, are from God and have overcome them, because the one who is in you is greater than the one who is in the world. 1 John chapter 4, verse 4. To say I was on the edge by the time Morgan got to Tots's would be generous. Exhausted and hungry, I was deprived of all care. Looking into my wild and weary eyes, he tempted me. "Hey, how about a nice trip up to Pat's house?" Though I hadn't ever had a nice trip to my mother's house, in my shattered state, my brother made a convincing argument. Nobody, he contended, would dare to disturb me at my mother's house. His voice was sugary sweet, and I was too drained to access my gut instincts. If I were at full capacity, I would have known my mother and her son were the last people I should be around when I was so vulnerable. Even if she cared for me, at that point, my mother knew nothing about me and nothing about what I was currently going through. She had absolutely no idea of the burden and responsibility of being an artist who generates so much money and energy. To have so many people living off of you, counting on you, pushing you to constantly work and work, to sing and smile and dress up and twirl and fly and write and work and work. She had no concept of the humiliation I was suffering from the ravenous media monster that was feeding off of me. She couldn't imagine how wounded and hunted I felt. My mother never could acknowledge my fear. In fact, she often triggered it. but now I was going to go back with them. Any house my mother was in never felt like a safe haven, especially if Morgan was present, yet I was far too fragile to resist. In my fogginess, it actually made sense to me to go upstate to the house I had bought her, the house I knew so well, where it was quiet and comfortable, and there would be plenty of room for everyone. Stripped of my better instincts, I agreed to go. But if I was going, I decided we were all going. Safety in numbers, I thought. So Morgan, Tots, and I went off on a ride upstate. Over the river and through the woods to my mother's house we go. Calamity and dog hair. My mother wasn't home yet from being in the city with the record label delegation at the hotel, and I was relieved. It meant I wouldn't run the risk of being provoked by her and Morgan together, and I especially didn't want to use the little energy I had left to try and explain to her why I just needed sleep. Thankfully, I also had my girl Tots as a buffer. As we approached the house, I began to relax a bit. I thought, this is the house I purchased for my mother and my family to live in, to find comfort in. Now I was the one who needed it more than anything. I had designed a guest room for anyone in the family who needed a place to stay that I knew I could surely use now. I could already picture its inviting warmth in my head. All I wanted to do was get a little bit of food in my stomach, get upstairs, close the door, and go to sleep before my mother got home. As we walked in the house, I was struggling to hide how wrecked I was, especially in front of my nephew Mike, who was still living there. He was just a kid and had already been through so much with his addicted mother. I wanted to spare him the traumatic history that was pulsing through me, through all of us, but I was also beginning to panic, realizing I was now isolated from the city and my actual home. I didn't have my driver, I was with Morgan, and my mother would be coming back any minute. They could be poisonous and manipulative together. I felt myself swinging back and forth out of the house and back to the shack. I was in their world now. The past and the present felt the same, unsafe. The house smelled of calamity and dog hair. I scanned the clutter and disarray. I never liked the way my mother kept the house. That's why I always had cleaning staff for her. Like my father, I've always liked things really clean. Mess causes anxiety for me. I began to put things in order, an activity I commonly do to recenter myself. I thought if I could bring some order to the chaos in the house, even in a small way, that I could stay in my body. But I kept slipping. I'm not helpless, I told myself. This was the beautiful house I had bought, created, and managed as an adult. I was not a little girl in a haphazard shack. I can bring order to this. But God, I was so tired. Maybe I thought, by some loophole of time and space, we really were back in the shack. I needed to sleep, desperately. And I was starved. My mind again began to race. I went to the kitchen to see if I could scrounge up a little morsel to eat. Typically, when visiting my mother, I would bring all the provisions needed, including disposable plates and cutlery, to ensure everyone would have enough to eat with an easy cleanup. In the kitchen, I found the sink piled high with dirty dishes. I knew it would help to ground me if I focused on a simple task, washing the dishes. That would work. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do the dishes, I thought. I'm going to eat off a clean plate, then I'm going to go to sleep. Reaching to turn on the faucet, I suddenly remembered. 6 days. I haven't slept more than 2 hours in 6 days. My hands trembled as I tried to begin the task I'd set for myself. All I could hear was my heart slamming inside my chest. What am I doing? Washing the dishes, right. After what seems like an eternity, I finally got one plate done and placed it in the rack. Next, I picked up a sudsy bowl, but I felt it slip through my fingers and clatter to the floor. I tried again. I got one done. I dropped one. Now I had to clean up the dish and water on the floor. The sounds of running water, clanging dishes, and people talking swirled together. I was frantically trying to clean up everything and get out of sight before my mother got home. I bent down to get the dish off the floor, and the light went dim and the sound started trailing off. All the space around me narrowed, and I started to fall away. I blacked out for a split second, but was able to recover before I completely collapsed. I made it. The surges of anxiety were gone, but so was every drop of my energy and every ounce of my will. But hey, if I couldn't go to sleep naturally, passing out would do just fine. With the help of Tots, I stumbled up the stairs toward the guest room, picking up clumps of dog hair on the steps along the way. I was barely conscious, but my standards were still awake. I was an exhausted refugee, and I thought that refuge was exactly what I had found. I collapsed onto the cozy bed, surrendering to its softness. Everything quickly turned to a long-awaited dark, and I sank down into it. Finally, peace.
Mariah, what are you doing? They're looking for you.
A booming, dramatic voice violently pulled me out of the pool of quiet in which I had been floating. Lost and sputtering, I was wrenched into consciousness to find my mother hovering over me. My own mother had woken me up from the first sleep I'd had in nearly a week. To make matters worse, she was waking me up to tell me that the record label was looking for me to get back to work, as if rather than being my mother and caretaker, she was some kind of agent for the machine that had repeatedly placed my earning potential over my well-being. That was the last straw. I really did leave my body. Something deep inside me rose quickly up and out of my throat. It was feral with seething rage.
Well, I did the best I could. I did the best I could. That's all you ever say.
I roared at her, imitating her exaggerated tones. It was a justification I'd heard from her over and over again for my entire life. After 6 days of being hunted down, 6 days of hiding, anxiety, and near demise, 6 days of no rest, 6 days of trauma, I had finally gotten to go to sleep in the house I'd bought only to be awoken by my own mother. My mother, who had found so much rest for herself in that house I'd worked so hard for. I wasn't expecting a hug or a kiss on the forehead, homemade chicken soup or baked cookies. I wasn't expecting a warm bath. I wasn't expecting a massage, hot tea, or a bedtime story. I wasn't expecting any comforts a sick child might receive from a healthy mother. I knew my mother didn't have the capacity for that kind of maternal response. After all, I was the one who took care of things. I took care of her. And everything else. I wasn't expecting her to do anything to help me feel better, but I certainly wasn't expecting her to wake me up. My rage took over. I couldn't see, I couldn't hear, I couldn't feel my body. As a survival response, I dipped into the depth of my sarcasm and made fun of her, viciously. Cutting to humor when faced with extreme stress or trauma had been a defense mechanism I developed as a child.
Well, I did the best I could. I did the best I could.
I imitated her mockingly over and over. I was trying to wake her up with her own words to the cruel absurdity of the moment. I knew it was wrong, but every filter I might have had to stop me had been ripped away. I screeched, "I just want to go to sleep." All my fears, all my resentment, all the years of impressions I'd done of her behind her back, all my anger was thrashing out with each word I hurled at her.
"Well, I did the best I could," I shouted.
No one, and especially not my mother, had ever seen me in such a rage. Throughout my childhood, it was always Morgan and Allison who would throw hysterical fits. They would scream and yell and throw condiment bottles at each other. They would fight. They would shriek and threaten my mother or knock her out cold. My brother and father had fist fights, but now it was my turn to let it rip. I wasn't violent or throwing obscenities, but I was still going off for me. I was in an angry, hysterical frenzy, but I was still also thinking about my nephew, Mike. I didn't want to continue the sick cycle we'd all been through. I was standing in front of his door, putting my body between my mother, my tirade, and his innocence. Before we arrived, I had asked Tots to look after Mike. I trusted her because of the countless nieces and nephews she had taken care of over the years. I never knew what could happen with my family, so she was behind the door comforting him. I was screaming, "This has to stop! We have to break the cycle!" All the fear and fury I had bottled inside myself was now directed at my mother. She was in the center of the cycle I was desperate to break. My mother was finally experiencing the full bloom of my anger and was ill-equipped to understand it or de-escalate it. She couldn't even get the joke. On the contrary, she felt threatened and embarrassed by it. She shook off her bewilderment. Then an iciness consumed her, and she shot me a look that said, "Oh, really? You dare mock me? You dare threaten me? You have no idea who you're messing with." When my mother feels scared, her complete assurance in the historic evidence that whiteness will always be protective activates, and she often calls the cops. At various times, she'd call the cops on my brother, my sister, and even my sister's children. My mother called the cops even when she didn't necessarily feel threatened. One Christmas, I brought my family to Aspen. It was the first year after I left Sing Sing, and I decided I wanted to create my own ultimate Christmas tradition, so I took the whole Carrie clan. For me, Christmas means family. I rented a house so I could decorate and have some home-cooked meals, and we could sing Christmas carols at the top of our lungs if we wanted to, and I put my family up in a fabulous hotel. At one point, we were all hanging out together at the house, and Morgan proceeded to get spectacularly inebriated. When he disappeared for a bit, my mother turned directly to her usual dramatics. "Where's Morgan?" she bellowed. "I can't find Morgan." Mind you, Morgan was a 30-something grown man, but still my mother was in a self-induced panic. "I can't find Morgan." She called his hotel room repeatedly, but there was no answer. So what did she do? She called the cops. My mother called the cops in Aspen, Colorado, to find my non-white, sometimes drug-dealing, been-in-the-system, drunk-ass brother. The cops came to the hotel and it was a whole big drama. She asked them to break down his hotel door, behind which it turned out Morgan was lying naked, butt up, passed out on the bed. The news spread like wildfire throughout the town, and that, ladies and gentlemen, was the last time Morgan and cop caller mom were invited to spend Christmas with me in Aspen. I really don't want a lot for Christmas, particularly not the cops. And so, that night in Westchester, she called the cops on me, too. The police arrived quickly, as they tend to do in white, affluent neighborhoods. My mother opened the door. I heard an officer ask, "Is there a problem, ma'am?" "Yes, we're having a problem," she replied, welcoming the two white policemen into the house. I could tell they kind of recognized me, though I was still in quite a state and looked it. I had been passed out, asleep, for the first time in nearly a week. In a tumultuous emotional whirlwind, I had quickly put my hair into a bun. I had on leggings and a t-shirt, as one would in one's home when one is trying to rest. I had somewhat pulled it together because that's what you do when there are police involved, but I didn't have on my superstar mask, which is how most everyone knows me, except for the lambs, of course. Without all the wardrobe and glam, I did appear troubled, perhaps a little wild or unwell. Though the officers were technically in my house, their attention was directed toward my mother. She gave them an odd, knowing look, which felt like the equivalent of a secret society handshake, some sort of white woman in distress cop code. She had been defied, and I had dared to be belligerent. I was being aggressive toward her. I was scaring her. And they received her signal loud and clear. It was in their training. The code was in her culture. This was her world, her people, and her language. She had control. Even Mariah Carey couldn't compete with a nameless white woman in distress. If I had been given just a day or two to rest, I would have woken up and been ready to make a video. But instead, here I was, standing in my mother's, actually my, house with the cops. The most terrifying part was that I was too worn out to feel my source. The negative energy of my mother, Morgan, and the police, the whole scene, blocked my light. I needed to see Tots. She had a big God in her life, too, and if I couldn't access mine, I thought maybe I could feel hers. I believed she could somehow keep me safe in a sisterly, spiritual way. I was trying to hold strong to her, but she was also really scared of the cops. And could you blame her? It's totally understandable. She was the only visibly 100% black person in the house. After successfully keeping out of trouble with police for years in the Brownsville projects, how could she explain to her mother that she'd gotten arrested in an affluent suburb and was in some upstate jail? Lord knows what they would have done to her in there. This was way before Black Lives Matter and cell phone activism, although even a movement hasn't stopped most of the brutality. So Tots was trying her best to keep herself and Mike away from the turmoil and out of sight. Against two white cops and one white woman in Upper Westchester, Tots knew she was outprivileged and totally outpowered. Given his long, turbulent history with law enforcement, Morgan was lying low in the little den we called the Irish Room. No one tried to explain to the police that it was just a family blowout, that everything was okay and I was just overworked and had lost my temper. I needed care, not the cops. But no one defended me. The only thing the cops saw was a scared white woman in a big house full of non-white people. Betrayed, humiliated, and overwhelmed by reliving the neglect and trauma of my childhood, I let go. Not that I had any fight left in me, but I knew better than to fight with the police. I was done. Ironically, I was relieved that the police could take me away from this house of trauma and betrayal. My brother had lured me back into the same depths of dysfunction that he, my sister, and my mother had dwelled in when I was a child. My mother had stolen me from my sleep, then turned me over to the authorities. There was nothing left to do but surrender. I agreed to be removed from my own house by the police with one simple request, that I be allowed to put on my shoes. My family might have taken my pride, my trust, and the last of my energy, but they weren't going to get my dignity too. I slipped on some heels, mules most likely, neatened my ponytail, slapped on some lip gloss, and got in the back seat of the squad car. Being hauled off by cops was certainly no comfort, but I was defeated and needed to get away by any means necessary. The firm seat cushions and the bulletproof protection inside the car provided a twisted sense of security. My body was reminded that it was still in critical need of rest. Morgan slid into the back seat next to me. I looked at him, empty of everything, unable to accept what my family had just done to me. I couldn't believe it. I had to outsource my pain, to put the blame on a substitute villain. I thought back to how it had all begun. When had things started to unravel? In a daze, I whispered, "This is all Tommy Mottola's fault." Morgan's eyes narrowed, and he flashed that sinister smile again. "That's right," he nodded. "That's right." We drove off into the darkness. Broken down. That night, I did not have a breakdown. I was broken down by the very people who were supposed to keep me whole. I knew of a place the locals called a spa that was very close, and I asked the police if they would take me there. They obliged. I wasn't familiar with the services or reputation of the place, but I figured at the very least I could finally get some sleep, some nutritious food, and perhaps some medical attention. After all I'd been through, I was very concerned about my physical condition. I knew enough to know I needed healing from the compounded trauma I had just experienced. My body was there, but my mind, my emotions, and my spirit were all powered down in what I now realize was protection mode. I remember getting out of the squad car and pacing in the parking lot, knowing I didn't belong in that place, but I didn't belong at my family house either. I didn't know where I belonged. After a long and groggy battle, Morgan convinced me to go inside. I could feel nothing. I signed myself in, believing I could sign myself out. I had no idea what I had actually signed myself up for. After speaking with some of the staff, Morgan left me there. The size, color, and smell of the place, the names, the faces of the people, I don't have much memory of the details. I was led to a small room at the end of a hall. I perceived it as windowless, though it most likely was not. There was a door to close me in. There was a bed. I curled up tight on top of it. Terror came quickly. I could hear the dull thud of a heavy mop hitting and sloshing on the floor in the distance and the muffled, mingled voices of young girls chatting and giggling. Every once in a while, I clearly heard them say, "Mariah Carey." The mop and the voices were getting closer and louder, settling right outside my door. Their laughter was ringing in my head. I coiled tighter into myself, shut my eyes, and tried to disappear. No relief came. I was deeply scared and completely alone. Prayer wouldn't come. Fear was my only companion. The whimpering of frightened people behind doors like mine never ceased as the torturous night crawled toward morning. The next day came. I was far from rested or clear-headed, but I was no longer totally numb. I knew I was in need of healing, peace, therapy, food, rest, and restoration. I needed care, and the rash decision to come to the closest place possible had clearly not been the right one. I was bombarded with frantic thoughts. Where is my purse? Where's all my stuff? What the fuck am I doing in this terrible, random place, sharing a bathroom I'm too scared to pee in? How do I get out of here? It was clearly not a spa. There was nothing therapeutic or restorative about it at all. It was closer to a prison, full of confused young people, unruly and unsettling. It was run like an upscale juvenile detention center. The food was disgusting. My mind was racing. Had my mother really called the cops on me, humiliated me, escorted me out of the house I bought? Was I really here now in some institution posing as a, quote, spa? The most frightening thing was that I had no control over my situation. I didn't have my car, my things, or any money. I didn't have my two-way pager to communicate with my people. There was only one single shared payphone. When no one was looking, I tried to call a few people, but to no avail. There was no privacy. I was walking around as a deflated Mariah Carey, stripped of her professional mask and powers, fully exposed to God knows what. While my memories of my interactions with staff and other patients are mostly vague, I distinctly recall being brought into a bare little office that felt like a police interrogation room, where an older, balding white administrator conducted a haphazard intake interview. I was clearly still upset, and it was difficult to quickly paint a picture of the misunderstanding that had happened at the house the night before, combined with the intensity and severity of all the work obligations I had ahead of me. I went on about having to shoot a video, about the film premiere preparations for Glitter, and about all the people dependent on me. I was riddled with anxiety and frustration that this man wasn't understanding the stakes. Not only was he not caring, he was hostile.
"Looks like you need a dose of humility," was his condescending response to all I had told him.
Oh, he thoroughly enjoyed spitting out that line. It was such an obvious and pitiful power grab. I could almost see him puffing up, believing he'd taken the diva down. Not only the tabloids revel in watching stars crash to the ground. I was defenseless, knifed in the back by my ex-husband and stabbed in the heart by my brother and mother. And they all left me to bleed out inside some hellhole. I went to try and sign myself out, but to my horror, I discovered that I couldn't. I don't know what my brother told the staff, but people were treating me like I was out of control and out of my mind, and most seemed to be enjoying it. It took several days of red tape and paperwork to get out. I knew Morgan and my mother had been communicating, and I strongly believe they orchestrated the whole thing. I returned to the scene of no crime, my mother's house, correction, my house. Coincidentally, there were paparazzi waiting in the woods to greet me. The cover of the next day's New York Post was a photo of me shot with a long lens through the trees in pajamas with little dark sunglasses and a messy bun, sipping juice through a straw. The photo was emblazoned with a giant caption, "World Exclusive, Mariah, the First Photos." My mother was thrilled. She exclaimed, "Look, it's just like Marilyn." It was not. The Daily News cover even gave her a mention, Mariah's crack-up. Mother's desperate 911 call as diva unraveled. When I went back to the house to retrieve my things with my road manager, my mother, in a drab house dress, was sitting on the floor of the porch in the rain, playing jacks in what appeared to be a trance. It kind of freaked my road manager out. What pathetic irony. Her glee at the tabloid coverage was no surprise to me. Even though I was the child who didn't break the rules or laws or bottles, my mother didn't seem to have the capacity to fully celebrate me as I matured into an accomplished artist. Sometimes I wondered if she couldn't even tolerate my achievements. I often felt like there was an undertow of jealousy pulling on her smile, though I still included her in many of the major events in my life. One of the greatest honors of my career was receiving the Congressional Award. I dreamed of receiving Grammys and Oscars for music or acting, but to be honored by my country for my service to others was a distinction beyond even my dreams, and I dream big. I was the recipient of the 1999 Horizon Award, which is given for charitable work focused on promoting personal development in young people for my work with Camp Mariah through the Fresh Air Fund. I'd never been deeply involved in politics, and at the time, I really didn't fully understand the significance of the award and the event. It's one of only two medals legislated by a congressional act, the other being the Medal of Honor. I was being honored along with former Secretary of State Colin Powell. We were hosted like dignitaries, and there was a very elegant, formal sit-down dinner before the ceremony. My mother and I were in high-powered, bipartisan company, including Tom Selleck, former Republican Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott from Mississippi, and former Democratic House Minority Leader Dick Gephardt, who ran for president a couple of times. This is one of the few events where both political parties put politics aside and proudly participate equally as Americans. On this night, in a room full of politicians, it's understood no one discusses politics. Even I know that. I was proud that a little girl who grew up feeling like an outcast now had an honored seat at one of the most esteemed tables in the world. I had my mother all dolled up, hair, nails, professional makeup. I bought her a new fancy dress, the whole nine. This was an occasion to look our best and be on our best behavior. Well, she had a few cocktails on the short plane ride from New York to Washington, D.C., and continued to booze it on up during the dinner. As the effects of the drinks kicked in, her decorum slipped away. She began to theatrically express her political opinions, which you absolutely don't do at a distinguished event like this, even stone cold sober. Her thoughts descended into insults, which melted down into a small but disturbing tirade. The one thing everyone knew not to do was what my mother was now fully engaged in. I was mortified. My security leaned over and whispered, "We have to get her out of here." I agreed. They whisked her out of the dining area and hid her in my dressing room near the stage for the award ceremony, apparently just in time, because it was reported to me that when she got into the room, she started yelling, "I hate Mariah. I hate my daughter." When I escaped from the dinner table to go and check on her, she was completely sloshed. I slid back to my seat and cheerfully performed as if all were well. Lord knows I've had lots of practice. I was escorted to the stage, accompanied by two beautiful young Black women from the Fresh Air Fund, who thankfully anchored me in the purpose of the evening. I managed to make it through my speech and accept the award. When I got off stage, it was clear we had to get my irate and inebriated mother out of the venue fast, as she was now throwing a full-blown fit. My security worked swiftly to get her into the car, to the airport, and on the plane. On the flight, still decked out in the designer dress I had bought her, she slinked into her first-class seat, continuing to drink and drone, "Morgan is the only one I love. Morgan is the only one who loves me." Security got my mother safely home and poured her into her bed. Alone in the back of a limo, in my black silk gown, hugging an award from my country, I cried. She may have been in a blackout and unaware of what she did or said, but I had to process the sadness, embarrassment, and pain of the experience. The next morning, I was nervous her booze-induced performance would make it into the press, but it didn't. I had protected her. I don't know who saw her, but mercifully, her congressional calamity did not make it into the tabloids. She didn't call to apologize. She didn't say anything. Being Mariah Carey is a job, my job, and I had to get back to it. I knew there would be eyes and lenses everywhere. I needed someone to light the way out of the darkness that place had become. By that time, I trusted only a handful of people, so before I was able to see my way out of the shadowy cabin in the woods, I called on my trusted friend and anchor, makeup artist Christopher Buckle, for support. He lifted me up, reapplied my protective public face, and walked with me into the sunlight. I was wounded, but I got myself back to my penthouse in Manhattan. There was so much recovery and repair to be done. I was still quite fragile, very concerned with the condition of my very new, very big deal at Virgin, and a very short time away from the release of Glitter. The coverage of my, quote, crack-up had everybody understandably shook, not least of all me. I had not regained my emotional or spiritual strength. I was still very much inside the nightmare, and Morgan was still very much in control. But I didn't see him as a puppeteer just yet. I still held a desperate, distorted trust in him. He had snapped me out of my screaming fit at the hotel by saying birthdays at Roybois. He was not in sight when the cops came in Westchester. He had ridden with me to the spa, so I didn't associate him with the current collection of catastrophes. He seemed at best an ally, at worst an innocent bystander. I needed someone, and I needed to believe that not everyone was against me. The pedestal I'd erected for my brother when I was a little girl had long since been reduced to rubble, but I kept trying to place him back on top of it. Though I could not see it then, we were clearly in ruins. If I had had my wits about me, or if someone on my payroll had known better, I would have had a team of specialists and professionals lined up to evaluate and treat me at my home. I did have the wherewithal to want to tuck myself away at an actual spa for a few days, where at least I could get some rest, wholesome food, maybe some body treatments, all the things I'd wanted on my way to that first hellish spa. I also wanted the opportunity to clear my head and protect myself and the label from more salacious headlines. Morgan recommended I go to Los Angeles, where he was currently living, making the case that there were actual spas there, true, and no New York newspapers, also true. A spa in LA seemed like a good idea at the time. I allowed Morgan to make the arrangements, not a good idea at any time, but I was desperate. When we got to L.A., my anxiety and disorientation was intensified by the tragedy of Aaliyah's sudden and horrific death. Just a few days earlier, she had told the press, "I know this business can be difficult. It can be stressful. Much love to Mariah Carey. I hope she gets better soon." The entire music industry was rocked by her death, but the R&B and hip-hop community was devastated. She was indeed our little princess. So much was happening, and I couldn't fully understand the magnitude of the damage being done to me. Morgan hooked up with some random guy who he said would be helping us. I remember driving around on the highway for what seemed like an eternity. We finally stopped at a place that did not look like a spa at all, but rather a detox facility. I was still in the hold of extreme exhaustion, so while I wasn't thrilled, I didn't resist. Morgan even went so far as to say, "Come on, it'll be fun." It was not fun. It was one of the most harrowing times of my life, and I had seen some times. Once more, I didn't have control of the situation. I could not speak up for myself, and when I could, I was ignored and overpowered. The facility in LA turned out to be a hardcore detox and rehab center. The first thing that happened to me was they administered drugs, heavy, hard narcotics. They were giant horse pills the color of Pepto-Bismol. At first, I refused to take them, but I didn't have the drive to fully fight. I was so weak. I thought maybe I would just be able to get a little sleep. Where was the Ambien when a girl needed it? Eventually, I did sleep, but fitfully. The drugs blocked me from whatever energy and will to fight I had in reserve. They put my big, bright god further in the shadows. They made me sluggish, puffy, and compliant. I was in a fog much of the time. Frumpily ensconced in some piece of shit, hideous institutional ensemble, I was drained and my soul was heavy. My face was vulnerable and hadn't had any protection in many days. That's one function of makeup. Even while giving a natural look, it can serve as war paint, an invisible force field. It often does for me. It shields me from people literally getting into my pores and under my skin, but I had no such protection in that place. One morning, I was in my bleak room, feeling drowsy, when an attendant came and brought me into the common area. It was crowded with staff and patients, and all were staring up at the large television in silence. On the screen was what looked like the view from the kitchen window in my New York City penthouse in the sky. But the picture was framed in chalky gray clouds of smoke. Orange and red fireballs were shooting out from the top of the glistening silver twin towers like meteors against a vibrant blue sky. Then the proud monumental buildings crumbled from within. One at a time, they came crashing down in excruciatingly slow motion. The effects of the drugs I'd been kept on were no match for the shock I was experiencing. In that instance, I was stone-cold alert as I watched my majestic skyline disintegrate. My home city was burning and collapsing, and I was thousands of miles away, locked inside a dismal detox, drugged, devastated, and alone. I was frozen, eyes locked on the horror unfolding before me, when someone from the staff tapped me on my shoulder. They told me it was being reported that terrorists had attacked the World Trade Center and that they would now be releasing me. I was free to go. Miraculously, it seemed, I was no longer in need of containment or sedatives. I was no longer crazy and out of control. So I was magically good to go because terrorists had attacked America and a cracked-up diva wasn't interesting anymore. Hello? But I didn't ask questions. I felt like the world was coming to an end for all of us, and if it was the end, I wanted to get the fuck out of there. Between being there, getting out, and the chaos and terror of the attacks back home, I didn't even realize it was the day the Glitter soundtrack was scheduled for release. The coincidence of my sudden release from rehab and the release of the Glitter soundtrack and the 9/11 attacks was haunting. You know how in a sci-fi horror film, the apocalypse happens and then there's a lone survivor wandering around surveying the devastation? That was me on that warm and cloudy day in LA on September 11th, 2001. I walked out of detox pumped full of toxins. The city of LA was solid, but I was shaky. I felt alone, untethered, and out of my body. I got myself to a hotel and had the first uninterrupted rest I'd had in weeks. With the tiny bit of strength that rest provided, I was able to finally get to an actual spa because I still had to do the best I could to prepare for the Glitter movie premiere, which was now only 10 days away. It was a blur, but I pulled myself together. I got some highlights, a cut, and a blowout. I wore a one-shoulder fitted tank top, as I do on the Glitter poster, but it had an American flag bedazzled on the front in honor of the victims and heroes. I paired it with simple low-rise jeans, held my chin high, and hit the red carpet at the Village Theater in Westwood with a smile. I was blessed to have lots of kids and young people at the premiere, as they were the intended audience. Glitter was not made for serious cinema-goers and art gallery hoppers. It was an imperfect, fun PG flick. The box office sales for Glitter were dismal, in large part because the country was still reeling from the 9/11 attacks. The tragedy was still fresh, and no one was ready for the lightweight distraction that was Glitter. Out of respect for our collective mourning, one would think the media would have turned their obsession away from me as well, but it seemed to only intensify. After the Glitter premiere, I stayed in L.A. to prepare for America, a Tribute to Heroes telethon, honoring the thousands who died in the attacks. Organized by George Clooney, it would be my first performance since I emerged from that nightmare of family, cops, and institutions. The biggest stars in entertainment, Tom Hanks, Goldie Hawn, Bruce Springsteen, Stevie Wonder, Muhammad Ali, Pearl Jam, Paul Simon, Billy Joel, Robert De Niro, and others, came out united as Americans. I sang Hero as Americans, first responders, and so many other brave, unnamed people showed the world what true heroes really look like. Never had I imagined when I wrote this song that it would mean so much in such a horrific moment in history. I was anxious to get back to New York. It was inspiring how the city immediately got to work putting itself back together in the wake of the attacks, and I was eager to put my life back together too. I wasn't permitted to resume residence in my penthouse yet, as much of Lower Manhattan was still closed off for safety and security reasons. In the meantime, I stayed in a hotel and blocked my family and others from getting to me. I was waking from the nightmare they'd created, and I had to get my own help. I wanted desperately to get back to being okay. I chose a therapist in upstate New York. He had a profound intellect, but also a deep sensitivity. His insights were not only acute, but comforting. He gave me a modern white Buddha vibe. Under his qualified care, I was able to begin to unpack the demoralizing and dehumanizing ordeal I had just been through. Losing my power and being put in scary, inappropriate institutions by my mother and brother while the press ravaged my reputation was almost the end for me. My therapist named the physical illness I'd been experiencing for so many years, all the nausea from being humiliated by kids and teachers, all the breaking out in hives all over, all the severe upper back and shoulder pain from stress from Tommy, all the dizziness and revulsion from the terror of my brother, all the psychological distress I endured, which wreaked havoc on my body, had a name: somatization. Having a highly respected professional name it validated what I was physically experiencing was real. It was suddenly all so real. My career was everything to me, and because of my mother, my brother, and Tommy, it was nearly taken away. Honestly, it felt like they almost killed me. They came close, but they didn't kill me or my spirit. They didn't permanently damage my mind or my soul, but Lord, they do try. There is nothing more powerful than surviving a trip to hell and coming home covered in the light of restoration. It wasn't an easy journey back to myself and to God, but I was back on my feet and walking forward. No one, I decided, was going to stop me or take all my power again, ever. In therapy, my emotions were safe to come out of the frigid hold of survival mode, and I was fucking furious. I was supporting everybody around me, and they had the audacity to throw me into institutions, give me drugs, and try to take control of my life. When I told my therapist what had happened, he assured me I was absolutely not crazy. At most, he said, I'd had a, quote, diva fit. It was a wonder I wasn't permanently emotionally damaged, given what I had lived through. However, I will probably always struggle with PTSD. He also affirmed that I was completely justified in being enraged. He very candidly suggested I imagine the role money had played in the experience with my family. I was so wrapped up in the childhood history, the betrayal, the love I had once had for everyone involved that I was blind to motive. It was no coincidence that my mother and brother were working on the side of the record company instead of protecting me and advocating for my well-being, and that they just happened to claim I was unstable and try to institutionalize me immediately after I had signed the biggest cash record deal for a solo artist in history. I could accept that I was a cash cow for record companies. After all, I was the franchise. It's the name of the game. It may be dirty, but I had no illusions that the music business was, first and foremost, a cutthroat business. But though I hadn't cut a business deal with my mother or my siblings, they were happy to take me to the slaughter, just like the record companies and the media. I knew for a long time that to my family, I'd been an ATM machine with a wig on, a moniker I gave myself. I gave them so much money, especially my mother, and still it wasn't enough. They tried to destroy me in order to take complete control. The therapist made an obvious suggestion. If they could prove I was unstable, they certainly could have believed they would have become the executors of my affairs. He asked me to look at them objectively, how they viewed the world, how they never really had consistent, legitimate work, but still felt like the world owed them something. We all had varying degrees of tough shit to go through in my family, but in this way, we fundamentally differed. I didn't think the world owed me anything. I simply believed I would conquer the world I was born into in my own way. As I worked myself to extreme exhaustion, they watched and waited for me to fall like scavengers so they might gain control over the fortune I had negotiated, built, and fought for. Years later, the pattern still continued, as patterns do. My family didn't change. One of the definitions of insanity, it's often said, is doing the same things over and over and expecting different results. My version of insanity was allowing the same thing to be done to me, over and over, by the same people. Please change your cast of characters. That was the simple and profound request my therapist eventually made. While I couldn't change the characters of my mother, brother, and sister, I did have the power to change how I characterized them in my life. So, for my sanity and peace of mind, my therapist encouraged me to literally rename and reframe my family. My mother became Pat to me, Morgan, my ex-brother, and Allison, my ex-sister. I had to stop expecting them to one day miraculously become the mommy, big brother, and big sister I fantasized about. I had to stop making myself available to be hurt by them. It has been helpful. I have no doubt it is emotionally and physically safer for me not to have any contact with my ex-brother and ex-sister. The situation with Pat, on the other hand, is more complicated. I have reserved some room in my heart and life to hold her, but with boundaries. Creating boundaries with the woman who gave birth to me is not easy. It is a work in progress. After I was broken, I received a blessing. The trouble and trauma I endured was not only emotional, it was spiritual as well. As such, I sought healing for my soul. I knew I had to revive and recommit to my relationship with God. I'm eternally grateful to have met my pastor, Bishop Clarence Keaton, when I did. I met him through Tots. We used to attend church together at True Worship Church Worldwide Ministries, right across from the Lewis Pink Houses Projects in East New York. Tots and I were even rebaptized there together. At True Worship, I became a student of the Bible, doing a 3-year intensive. We went through it from Old to New Testament. I took notes, and I took the healing words in. Bishop Keaton used to be a pool shark. He lived a very different life before becoming a pastor. He'd already earned respect in the neighborhood, when at that time it would not be uncommon to duck bullets in broad daylight, so he had protection, and people didn't mess with him. I would have security provided by the church, and the congregation would respect my privacy. The bishop saw to it. I found community in the church and family in my bishop, who treated me like a daughter. He often came to talk to me, even when he was going through health issues toward the end of his life. It was such an honor to solidify Bishop Keaton's legacy as a great spiritual teacher in my life and in the world by featuring him on two of my songs, I Wish You Well and Fly Like a Bird. He and the True Worship Choir joined me on Good Morning America to perform Fly Like a Bird before he took flight on July 3rd, 2009. Having a family in God brought me back to my life in the light. Pat couldn't understand. She left me a snide phone message on my BlackBerry. What is this with you and your new friends and your new prayers? None of my biological family understood what it meant to care so much about God, but I had to. Returning to God was the only way I made it out of all my trips to hell. I believe my ex-brother and ex-sister have been to a hell of their own. They may still be trapped there. They chose drugs and lies and schemes to survive, but that only seemed to dig them in deeper and to make them resent me more. And I still pray for them. Maybe when you're cursing me, you don't feel so incomplete, but we've all made mistakes, felt the guilt and self-hate. I know that you've been there for plenty, maybe still got love for me, but let him without sin cast the first stone, brethren. But who remains standing then? Not you, not I. See Philippians 4:9. So I wish you well. I wish you well. So, gradually, I overcame the dark time that my family had dragged me through. And after all that shit, Loverboy ended up being the best-selling single of 2001 in the United States. I'm real. Part 4. Emancipation. My cousin Vinny. After the whole glitter fiasco, Virgin was spooked and wanted to change my deal to make it much less significant. They felt they couldn't justify spending all that money on such an unstable person. The woman who had signed me was fired, and they brought in two new people from England to replace her. I remember the first day I sat down with them. Basically, they were pretty fucking awful. They were trying to change the deal, and I just knew I had to get out of there. Getting to Virgin had seemed like a triumph because I was so desperate to get off Sony. Virgin wasn't as big, but it was a boutique label, and I knew how well they had taken care of Lenny Kravitz and Janet Jackson. They offered me such a good deal, in part because they weren't as slick and influential as other labels. They didn't know all the tricks that Sony and the other big labels knew. They were eclectic and saw me as a big, shiny star. Initially, I chose Virgin over a larger and more cutthroat label for the deal they were offering, but when they wanted to, quote, adjust it with all new players, I had no reason to stay. They offered a revised agreement wherein they would pay me much less and have much more control. I refused. Instead, the CEO of Universal Music Group, the genius Doug Morris, and visionary hip-hop music executive Lior Cohen, we both had come a long way since I met him on the street with Will Smith singing Rob Bass and DJ Easy Rock's It Takes Two, came to my penthouse. The three of us sat in the living room with Marilyn's white baby grand, and over champagne, Doug proclaimed, "You know what, Mariah? We're going to do this. I think we're really going to do this." I felt safe and seen. They would have to pay a pretty penny to get me out of the deal I had with Virgin, but they were willing. I was like, fuck everybody else. I'm still good. I'm still here. I mean, I had two of the top music executives in the world on my couch with no middlemen. We were going to be all right. After all of the trauma I'd experienced, the faith and trust Doug showed in me and his exciting vision for the future renewed me. And I was going to do it. I had no intention of dying with the 90s, as Tommy had prophesized. I always knew I could be even bigger than he saw. I had so much more music inside of me. Ready to begin again, I signed my new deal. The first album I made on Universal was Charm Bracelet. Recording Charm Bracelet was a chance at restoration and recuperation after the disaster that was Glitter. Waiting at the end of my rainbow bridge to freedom was a kind of paradise, an oasis, quite literally. I recorded a lot of the album in the Bahamas and on the Isle of Capri, a semi-secret, retro-glamorous getaway like the old Hollywood of Italy. In the Bahamas, we did several live music sessions with Kenneth Crouch of the legendary Crouch Gospel Family, Randy Jackson, and a bunch of other talented artists, including Seven Aurelius, who had been making big hits with Ashanti at the time. I was back in my sweet spot, laying down light and airy vocals over heavy hip-hop tracks. All of us were there in the gorgeous Bahamas, just writing music. I loved those sessions. I'm glad I was able to arrange that because I needed a palate-cleansing moment. Jermaine and I did The One together. I wanted The One to be the lead single, but Doug chose Through the Rain. It was a serious ballad, and Doug thought it would work because it was kind of a sob story, the sort of triumphant Oprah Winfrey moment I needed in the wake of the Glitter debacle. It was a good song, but it didn't perform as well as it could have. The label was really invested in the adult contemporary genre, which I could do in my sleep, but personally, I had always preferred the so-called, quote, urban contemporary, whatever that means. I went back to Capri, to the gorgeous studio on the top of a hill. It was so great. There are no cars, there's no pollution, and the air and the energy are very clean. I didn't have kids at the time, but kids could run around freely there because it was so safe. You can only get there by ferry, and so it made for the perfect hideout for me to hunker down and record. People came out to visit me. Lior brought Cameron out there for a day to record Boy, I Need You. Cam snuck in some of that purple, cannabis, and he administered very effective shotguns. I don't inhale directly, the vocal cords, darling. We got fully festive and watched Mel Brooks's History of the World Part 1, one of my all-time favorite movies, and laughed our asses off. One of the songs I love on Charm Bracelet is Subtle Invitation. That song is a great example of how I often take the small moments that happen in life and channel their larger significance so that my music can connect to people all around the world who are going through different experiences and coming from different situations and positions. Though the song was about a brief and fleeting fling, it wasn't a resentful song. It was for anyone who could relate to experiences of losing a love but keeping the door open to it. See, it's hard to tell somebody that you're still somewhat attached to the dream of being in love once again when it's clear they've moved on. So I sat down and wrote these few words on the off chance you'd hear. And if you happen to be somewhere listening, you should know I'm still here. If you really need me, baby, just reach out and touch me. Subtle invitation. Another important song for me was My Saving Grace. I've loved a lot, hurt a lot, been burned a lot in my life and times, spent precious years wrapped up in fears with no end in sight, until my saving grace shined on me, until my saving grace set me free, giving me peace, giving me strength when I'd almost lost it all, catching my every fall. I still exist because you keep me safe. I found my saving grace within you. My saving grace. Charm Bracelet was a real fan favorite. The Lambs have always wanted justice for Charm Bracelet, and it was actually a really good album. It featured Jay-Z and Freeway on You Got Me, Cameron on Boy, and West Side Connection on Irresistible. Joe and Kelly Price joined me on the Through the Rain remix. The album was a real transition from what I'd left behind into a new chapter. Universal supported me and stuck by my side. It didn't feel like the hostile battle zone that was Sony during Tommy's reign. Commercially, Charm Bracelet wasn't massively successful, but Doug didn't give up on me, and thank goodness, because liberation was just over the horizon. It was around 2003 after Charm Bracelet had been released. I recall that time as a rare moment when I felt free-ish and rather unattached. I was kind of seeing a guy, but just seeing, nothing else. I just wanted to have fun. That night, it was Cameron, Jim Jones, Juelz Santana, and Tots, and me. We'd been hanging out all night, clubbing, cocktails, you know, the whole thing, and we ended up back at my place, up in the Moroccan room. Many things start in the Moroccan room. When I first traveled to Morocco, the country spoke to me. I was inspired by the flavor of everything, the colors, the fabrics, the textures, the smells, the lushness, the exoticness, the glamour it was giving. It was all so mysterious and sensual. The restaurants, the homes, the hotels, they were all fantastically designed, all ultra-comfortable yet dramatic. You must keep it dramatique, dramatique, for me to love it, darling. I wanted to recreate that rich, glamorous feeling in my home, to create a beautiful place where I could make an easy escape. Silk pillows everywhere, leather tufts, embellished little tables, hammocks, ornate lanterns. I brought in fabulous North African accoutrements to make my own urban oasis, the exotic cherry on top of my beloved penthouse. It was the height of the ghetto fabulous fashion era, and we were living it. Diamonds and denim galore on all the boys. Cameron was probably wearing a powder pink leather and flamboyantly furry ensemble. He was in his pink phase. I'm certain I was in some scandalous micro designer frock. So we're all dressed up and sprawled out amongst a cacophony of cushions. It was almost dawn, and in the IMAX-like view from the wall of windows, the night sky was changing like a mood ring to shades of purple and pink. The whole aura of the room was purple. After all, Dipset, known formerly as the rap supergroup The Diplomats, loves everything purple. All of a sudden, Cam bursts out, "Let's go uptown." We were still feeling festive, so it sounded like an inspired idea. Cameron is Harlem, so we trusted he would know of the appropriate shenanigans for late night into early morning. Me and Cam got into his Lamborghini, which was purple, of course. Everyone else giddily hopped into their own exotic cars. My bodyguard, not so giddy, was trailing us in a big black SUV. There we were, a small convoy of rappers and dolls in unimaginably expensive cars roaring east across a sleepy canal street, which soon would be buzzing with Chinese and Senegalese vendors setting up their open-air markets of knockoff luxury handbags and watches. But at barely 6 a.m., aside from a street sweeper or the occasional trash truck, it was just us, speeding down the wide street, being young and fabulous, cutting through the quiet of the gritty city. We were headed to the Franklin Delano Roosevelt Drive, which lines the entirety of Manhattan's smooth eastern edge. The FDR doesn't have traffic lights, so I knew Cam and the boys were ready to rip. Back then, and to this day for sure, it was life-threatening to be a young black man in an exotic sports car speeding up the highway, especially on Manhattan's east side. But we were high on a night of frivolity and other purple treats, tearing into the fresh morning. We were feeling young, sexy, and free. The fear of arrest, or death for that matter, was nowhere in sight. We were chasing fun and freedom, and we captured it, if only for a few miles, on a stretch of New York City highway. As one might imagine, much of my life has been monitored and measured by other people, and in this moment of exhilaration, I got the urge to try and lose my security. Cam eagerly accepted the challenge, shifted gears, and hit the gas. It was like being shot out of a cannon, and the big black vehicle with the big bad bodyguard instantly became a tiny speck in the rearview mirror. Cracking up the whole time, we felt as if we'd just pulled off the hip-hop version of a Little Rascals-type caper, with me playing Darla, of course. I've often felt it was a struggle to just have fun, to keep that inner child alive, but I remembered that promise I once made to myself that I would never forget what it felt like to be a kid. I would never let my little girl go. By the time we peeled off the FDR at 135th Street, the sun had risen. Good morning, Harlem. As we pulled up to the stoplight at the corner of Lenox Avenue next to Harlem Hospital, I realized we were somewhere close to my great-aunt Nana Reese's church. I only knew of it through stories and a single photograph, but I thought if anyone could help me find this brownstone basement church, it was Cam. And that's exactly what he did. This wasn't a paper picture in a frame. I was actually there. I could touch the bricks that my family once owned. In the place where they lived, prayed, sang, cried, praised, married, died, and caught the spirit, this is where they had church. I know much of my parents' families through frozen moments and gilded frames. My family pictures are sacred. They ground me, reminding me who I come from and who has come and gone from me. These photographs are kept in a private little room off my house.